This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There are a lot of oddball things happening in the economy right now. In the words of a recent Wall Street Journal article, wild cards such as plummeting oil prices, strong U.S. hiring, weak wage growth, China's wobbly economy, and a U.S. central bank willing to raise interest rates after many years. Also, the stock market's been on an unsettling ride lately, even raising fears about another economic downturn. But most American observers are not pronouncing the R word, meaning recession. Many say the fundamentals of our economy are strong, even with these concerns. Today in The Exchange, we take the economy's temperature and look ahead to this new year. And later in the hour, a quick check-in on the hot debate over solar power in the New Hampshire legislature around the wonky-sounding concept of net metering. First, though, as we turn our attention to the economy, let's hear from you, your own assessment of what its strengths and weaknesses are right now, how you're personally feeling the economic trends in your own life. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Russ Tebow, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. And Russ, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Also joining us from Hanover, Matt Slaughter, dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And Matt, welcome back to you too. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Laura. Pleasure to be here.
Well, that opening quote, Matt, from the Wall Street Journal, I love that because it kind of sums it up, doesn't it? A lot of oddball things going on in the world economy right now. What do you think?
There are a lot of oddball things going on. The new year has brought us excitement, if nothing else. And I think it speaks to the underlying economic reality, which is economic growth is slowing in a lot of parts of the world. It's not as fast as we would like in the United States. It's much slower in China, second-largest economy in the world. Has raised a lot of uncertainty among investors about how their underlying companies are going to be performing. It's raised a lot of uncertainty about what policymakers are understanding what they might do. And so this volatility that we're seeing in energy prices and in stock prices looks to be something that is going to be with us in 2016 for at least a while.
Yeah, I'd love your thoughts too, Russ Tebow, please, on just how the new year kind of opened with, again, some volatility, as Matt puts it.
Yeah, volatility and really we're not sure what's going on. Last month, the Fed raised interest rates, as you pointed out, for the first time in multiple years, which signaled their confidence in the U.S. economy. And then we hit the first of the year and the stock market's down by 8 to 10% here in the United States and as much as 40% in Shanghai, China. So what
40%?
Yeah.
Wow.
The issue really is this. We don't know whether this is a correction, that the U.S. stock market that will kind of self-adjust, or whether it's the early sign of maybe something more significant for the U.S. economy. As you pointed out, there's a lot of good numbers out there. Last month's figures on job growth in the United States showed almost 300,000 new jobs added, unemployment rates exceptionally low. We had a healthy GDP growth factor in the third quarter. We have low interest rates. Housing's affordable. So all of the fundamentals look really good. But then we know we're standing on ice and we're not sure how thick or thin it is. It's really kind of the
issue.
That's a good
analogy for this time of year.
Yeah, and on the other hand, as economists are fond of saying, there is a lot of concern out there. The Chinese downturn, the third largest economy in the country, Brazil is struggling with a 30% drop in the value of the real. So all of the oil exporting countries are really suffering. And sort of lower oil prices are good on the one hand. We're all spending less to heat our houses, get our cars rolling in the morning. On the other hand, this the tremendous drop in oil prices from $130 a barrel to now under $28 a barrel is really disruptive to a big part of the United States economy and the world economy. So we're not sure where that plays out. But it's come all of a sudden, kind of almost out of the blue. There were some early signs. The stock market was pretty flat last year. Consumer confidence was a little bit lower towards the end of the year. But by and large, this has been somewhat really a kind of a surprise. And we're not sure where it all heads. So there's a lot of uncertainty. Right now, I think consumers haven't dropped back their spending yet. The numbers still look solid, but we have a big number coming out at the end of the month, GDP for the fourth quarter. So at this point, you don't see a lot of changes in the way people are spending money or acting. The unemployment rate doesn't seem to have climbed, but we're not sure where the future holds.
Okay, so a lot there to pick apart.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Hour. Yeah, that's okay.
A lot of
that's
gabbing.
What we're talking about.
Okay.
We'll look at that GDP, the unemployment, the stock market, oil, China, all of that as we look in at the economy in this new year today in the exchange. Let's hear from you. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'd love to get your perspective on the economy, how you are feeling, some of the trends that we're talking about. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And, you know, Russ, if you could just dig into the oil price drop a little bit more. It's so hard to figure out. You know, when oil prices are high, we hear, oh, this is hurting the world economy. Oil prices are high and manufacturers are having to spend more money running their plants and so forth. Now they're really low and we hear, oh, this is so terrible. You know, I mean, help us figure this out.
Yeah, you just can't win when it comes to oil prices.
Is there
I guess
a sweet spot, a Goldilocks zone for oil prices?
Yeah, maybe once you get, I think that you can get adjusted to oil prices not at any level, but at many levels. We can all adjust to it. As consumers, we can adjust to relatively high oil prices by cutting back on buying more efficient cars and cutting back on how much we heat our houses. But what happens when oil prices drop is it's a bonus for consumers. But for oil producers, it's a pain. It's painful.
Sure.
And there's a lot of the world economy that is dependent on oil exports. Excuse me. Russia is, Venezuela is, the Middle East is, and this causes a disruption. And much of America is. There's a lot of construction employment that's developed over the last 3 or 4 years in terms of developing this shale oil business. So it's kind of a mixed blessing, the lower oil prices, a benefit for consumers. But the volatility of this, the suddenness of it, from $130 a barrel last year to under $28 this year, is hard to adjust to in the short term.
Can we say whether it's a net benefit or a net drawback, harm? I mean, I understand that, there's always winners and losers, but is there a net gain to low oil prices?
For consumers, there is in the short term, definitely. I think for producers over the mid to long term, it probably requires more adjustment than we can handle easily in the short term. So short-term consumers benefit, short-term producers, it's painful. So it's a mixed blessing.
Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we talk about the economy and how it began on sort of, as the Wall Street Journal put it, an oddball footing in the new year. 1-800-892-6477. We're having a little bit of trouble with Matt Slaughter's line, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, and we'll go back to him in just a moment when we figure that out. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. So another oddball, if I could put it that way, Russ, is the fundamentals of the U.S. economy seem strong. You mentioned those job numbers, for example. But then the stock market is having fits. So help us untangle that.
Yeah, I think that what's going on is uncertainty is not a friend of the stock market. And there is a great deal of uncertainty about these world events that is being reflected in the United States stock market, which, by the way, has had its worst start to the year ever, this start to the year, where it's down about 8%.
Worst start to the year
ever? Ever, right. Yeah. Down around 8 to 10%. Depending, in some measures, if you look at the Russell 2000 index, which is small stocks, it's down over 30% for, small stocks. So I think that the impact is there's multiple layers of impact. The immediate impact that we know has happened is that the value of people's 401ks, the value of their stock portfolios, is down. So there's an immediate wealth effect that we know is there. It's there.
They just don't feel as flush because
right, exactly.
the value is down.
That exactly. And so that's a direct impact of what's going on now. We know that that's happened. And roughly 55% of American households have money in the stock market, directly or indirectly. And if you go to split it out by income, middle income and upper income people, it's closer to 90%. So this stock market downturn has a wealth effect that permeates much of American households, many of American households. The question becomes, what next? We know that's happened already. We don't know how long it will last. It may self-correct. We don't know. The next layer is, are people going to pull back on their spending because of that? And that is a trigger that we just as soon not see pulled. If people pull back on their spending, then businesses pull back on their hiring, and the R word starts getting to be more prominent. Now,
the R word meaning recession.
Recession, right. Now, the survey of economists, the most recent survey of economists by the Wall Street Journal, the probability of a recession is very, very low still. But you can't rule it out completely. And this is not the kind of thing that gives you a comfort level. Rather, it's disconcerting to see the world economy moving the way it is, the sudden disruption in oil prices, the Chinese third largest economy in the world suffering. So it makes it more difficult for us to as economists, to anticipate a bright future.
Well, I'm thinking of an analogy, Russ, and you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, but it almost seems like, you know, you talked about the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, strong, you know, if we could put it this way, Main Street's doing pretty well, Wall Street is having all these anxieties. It's almost like the heart and the head, like Main Street's the head, right? It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of mm-hmm. sober and says things are good, we're moving along, and then Wall Street is sort of the heart, which is sort of anxious, and what about this, and what about that, and I'm fearful about China, and I'm fearful about, you know, the world political situation and ISIS and so forth. I wonder if that's sort of the disconnect there.
Yeah, we have cross currents right now in the economy. As you pointed out, a lot of the fundamentals are very good, but the stock market itself, which is a reflection of the economy, but sometimes anticipating future economic events, is weak right now and exceptionally weak. So at this point, the big question is, are consumers going to react to this by pulling back? And if they do, I think that increases the probability of issues. And as I said, it's much harder to construct a favorable scenario for the United States for this year than it was before all of these disruptions popped up. So we just don't know. You know, and there's another thing that I'll mention, and I'm not a political scientist by any means, but there is a lot of discourse in the presidential campaign that really is negative. And I think that kind of adds to people's anxiety. We're being told that the U.S. economy is really, and the U.S., United States generally, is really suffering and major changes need to take place. And I think that kind of gets to people as well.
You know, Matt Slaughter is back with us from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And Matt, I'd love your thoughts, too, on this sort of disconnect between Main Street and Wall Street. We hear that, you know, the fundamentals of the U.S. economy are strong, but Wall Street is having headaches.
Boy, great question. And I'll use one of Russ's nice metaphors of thin ice and thick ice in the snowy January we have here in New Hampshire. The irony is there's a Nobel laureate economist named Paul Samuelson who once quipped, this is many years ago, but I'm paraphrasing, he said, the stock market has predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions in the United States.
In other words, don't worry about it too much, folks.
Right, meaning there are a lot of reasons that you see a lot of sharp volatility in stock market prices and other asset prices. Sometimes they're a predictor of real slowdown in economic activity, meaning slowdown in hiring for companies and falling profits and real economic trouble on Main Street. Sometimes it's related to other forces such as just the uncertainty of investors about what the future is going to be, and so they're less sure about.
Yeah, and again, I think we're having problems with that line at Dartmouth. Matt,
right,
are you there?
We pointed out earlier.
Yeah, go ahead.
As Russ pointed out earlier.
Mm. Okay. Well.
I think I can kind of pick up on what Matt was saying, which is that the stock market is not necessarily a great predictor of the economy. That Oftentimes, the stock market can be a leading indicator of an economic downturn, but more often than that, it kind of is reflective. That probably the primary indicator, early indicator of a recession, is a combination of consumer confidence and unemployment rates. And if consumer confidence dips and unemployment rates rise, we're heading into troubled waters in terms of the U.S. economy. So I looked at it before coming on the show, looking at consumer confidence and its impact. Is it a leading indicator of an economic downturn, a stock market downturn? And it can be somewhat of a leading indicator, but not always. So there's no easy answer to the question.
Well, I love that quote that Matt gave us from Samuelson, that the stock market has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions.
Yes, so. Exactly. Yeah.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'd love your assessment of the economy here in New Hampshire and nationally, given, again, some of the mixed signals that we're getting from abroad especially. 1-800-892-6477. And Richard's calling in from Guilford. Hi, Richard. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Yes, hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is that we all have more money in our pocket. The middle class should be feeling the love of the low oil prices, low heating. Yet, they're faced with uncertainty in health insurance, high deductible plans, trying to work, and pay out money for health insurance. Yet, if they get sick, they're $5,000 in the hole. And you turn on the TV and the Republicans give us no help whatsoever. They're just gloom and doom about everything. No one's going to spend their money. The retirees' plans are down. They're not going to spend. So I would like them to address that, not just what Wall Street's telling us. They don't reflect the middle class.
Richard, thank you for calling in. So he's saying, hey, we all have more money in our pockets. We should be feeling good about that. But health insurance costs continue to rise and take a bite out of people's incomes.
Yeah, health insurance rise. And while wages are going up a little bit now, finally deep into this recovery, it's only a little bit. So I think that Richard is right. There's still a lot of angst among households, even with lower energy prices. And it's wonderful to see them. Driving down this morning, I saw gasoline at $1.80 a gallon. That is great compared to, I think we were over $4 for a while. So that does put money back in consumers' pockets. And we're very sensitive to the price of gasoline, for example, and heating oil, because it gets posted in front of us every time we drive down the road. So, but that's the lower energy costs are only part of our spending as consumers and not much of our income. So he's right. Overall, consumers are still it's surprising. We've had great job growth in this recovery. Unemployment is very, very low. Prices, inflation is low. These are good things for consumers. But yet there's this sense that, going back to my analogy, we're on thin ice. I think that's kind of
maybe people are still feeling uncertain because of the recession, even though, you know, federal economists said it officially ended back in June of 2009. Mm-hmm. You know, people are still maybe feeling a little nervous about popping economic champagne, if I could put it that way.
Yeah. Well, if you look at what drove the last recession, declining home prices, for example, and the stock market debacle last time around. So people's wealth really shrunk tremendously. And it hit just about everybody. Almost everybody has somebody in their family or a friend that lost their job, that maybe lost a house. All of us had a 20% drop in the value of our house, which is our primary investment, and more in terms of the 401k. So, but there's one thing I want to say as well about the stock market being down here, the Dow down around 8-10%. That really only gets us back to like mid to late 2014. It's been a tremendous run for the stock market. So by and large, most investors that have money in the stock market are still ahead of the game. This is not something you like to see, coming on the heels of a relatively flat last year, but it's not the end of the world either. So most of us are still ahead of the game.
Coming up, more on the economic outlook for 2016. We'll focus more in on jobs and hiring and some of those employment numbers that you talked about, Russ. We'll also take more of your questions and comments. Richard, thank you for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the economic outlook for 2016, some concerns on the world economic front, but strong fundamentals here in the U.S. as well. Let's hear from you, your own economic outlook for the new year. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Russ Tebow's in studio, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. Matt Slaughter is back with us, dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And Matt, turning to you and looking now at the labor market, I'd love your thoughts on this idea that hiring is strong, but wages are still soft. So what's your assessment of that, Matt?
It's a really accurate assessment, Laura, of where the U.S. economy is. We never quite know what exactly full employment is in the labor market. That's the notion of pretty much anyone looking for a job has one. There's always some frictional unemployment, as economists call it, of people transitioning from jobs who quit to look for something better. We're basically at full employment with the unemployment rate at 5%. And yet the challenge is that we've been creating a lot of jobs in this recovery, which is terrific. We've added over 14 million jobs over the past 70 straight months. That's the longest streak on record. A lot of these aren't the good jobs in terms of high and rising wages, and that's a fundamental challenge that remains for the U.S. economy. One of the big reasons we're not getting a lot of wage growth is because the firms are not exhibiting a lot of what we call productivity growth. So the jobs that are being created aren't high in a lot of kind of the capital intensity and new technologies. Some are obviously in the economy, but not enough that wages overall are rising. And I think especially here in New Hampshire in the presidential campaign season, there's a clear sense when you look at the public opinion data that Russ mentioned earlier of a lot of Americans, independents, Republicans, Democrats alike, where a major source of their economic anxiety is this sense of we're not creating the good jobs that we would like to have happen, that we used to create in the U.S. in the past. And when you look at the appeal of both Senator Sanders and Donald Trump, though they're on very different sides politically and policy-wise on the spectrum, they're both tapping into that anxiety about wage growth.
So even though there are a lot of jobs, the wages aren't as good as they were before, where you could support a family and so forth. Manufacturing and tech, what happened to those jobs, Matt?
So a lot of what happens to those jobs, paradoxically, is it's part of how we get innovation and productivity growth. So with manufacturing jobs, for example, last calendar year across 2015, the U.S. economy basically had almost no growth in manufacturing jobs. Part of that is what the show here has been talking about, which is the slowdown in economic activity in some of our trading partners like China. But part of it is the ongoing process of innovation where companies figure out new and more creative ways to produce their goods and services without needing as many workers. So manufacturing, I think a lot of people focus on, but it's important to keep in mind there's only about 12 million people in the United States today that work in manufacturing out of a total labor force of about 158 million workers.
Wow, not very much.
It matters. Manufacturing is definitely special. It's special here in New Hampshire. But when you're looking at the U.S. labor market overall, there's more people that work at retail trade in the United States by a few million than there are in manufacturing overall. And so the question about growth of good jobs has to focus, I think, a lot more on how can, in a lot other industries, can we support the kind of dynamism that creates those good jobs?
Again, our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go next, gentlemen, to Charles in Amherst. Hi, Charles. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
My question for the panel today is, what do they see the tools are available for the Federal Reserve, given the extraordinarily strong dollar and the weakening global economy? You know, what tools are available? What can our Federal Reserve do as China continues to devalue its currency and similar actions by other countries around the globe?
Wow, Charles, great question. And Matt Slaughter, I did want to ask you about the Federal Reserve. That's another one of the things that made the new year start off on an uncertain economic note. The Federal Reserve raising interest rates for the first time in a long time. Just before you jump into the impact of that, Matt, just remind us, how does the Fed do that?
A great question, Laura, and Charles as well. The Fed is very powerful, but it's not omnipotent. It can't do everything. So what the Fed mainly is able to do by printing money metaphorically with its balance sheet is it adjusts a couple of key interest rates in the U.S. economy. You oftentimes hear it referred to as the federal funds interest rate. That's an interest rate for short-term loans between banks, overnight loans. By changing that interest rate, and there's different ways that the Fed can do that, that feeds through all of American capital markets to the interest rates that a lot of businesses and consumers like you and me see. So the interest rates on our mortgages or the balance on our credit card, those interest rates tend to vary, although not perfectly and in ways that are sometimes unpredictable, with the interest rates that the Fed can clearly control. Legally, the charge of the Fed is to try to hit two broad policy goals. It's to try to help maximize employment in the United States consistent with price stability. And so the logic for Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, and others in recent months and why they raised interest rates at the end of last calendar year is because, as we were talking about a minute ago, we're pretty close to full employment at this point. And so part of the logic for the Fed is looking ahead to this uncertain future we've been discussing. If they can raise interest rates today, that might give them the option down the road if China continues to weaken, if Brazil weakens, if other forces buffet the U.S. economy, maybe to lower interest rates in the future. But this is one of the ways in which policymaking is really art, not science. And there's a lot of judgment calls that the Federal Reserve and other policymakers have to make about when and how to change interest rates.
Sure, it's a big decision and a big deal, Russ Tebow. What are some of the concerns about these actions by the Fed?
Well, I think that the main thing is that it can have, if dramatic enough, and the quarter percent raise in December probably is not dramatic enough to have a really dramatic effect on the U.S. economy. I think it was almost more psychological, the Fed saying, look, we feel pretty comfortable about the way things are. We think you guys can handle a quarter percent raise in interest rates and start getting us towards a more normalized interest rate environment. Low interest rates are like the oil discussion we had earlier. They're a mixed blessing. They're great for borrowers, but for savers, if you've looked at what you can get on a one-year certificate of deposit, it's almost not worth sending the check into the bank. The postage is more than what you're going to get in terms of return. So I think the Fed made that move. They had signaled during the year they expected to raise rates. On the one hand, it is an endorsement of the U.S. economy and their confidence in the economy. On the other hand, I don't think that rate increase in and of itself has had and is going to have much of an impact. Now, the Fed had talked about four more blips upward this year. I think they're going to reassess that in terms of what's been going on. If rates were to jump a full percentage point, what would be called 100 basis points, I think that would be dramatic, particularly, for example, on housing, if it got translated into higher long-term rates as well.
Well, one more question from our caller. And Charles, again, thank you for joining us. He also asked about China, Matt Slaughter, and we've gotten used to hearing about China's, you know, robust economic growth. What's happening in China right now? Why the big slowdown?
That's another great question. What's happening in China is their amazingly fast rate of economic growth is slowing. And by amazingly fast, we should all have in mind from when they started their liberalization of policies in the late 1970s after Chairman Mao died up until a couple of years ago. Their total economy, their gross domestic product, grew at an average annual rate of almost 10% per year, which is just remarkable. So that's the doubling of the size of the Chinese economy every 7 years, roughly. Now the sustainable growth rate for China has fallen a lot. The Chinese government reported just yesterday that for all of 2015, their economy grew by about 6.9%.
Now, that sounds really good.
Bingo. Boy, it would be great if we in the United States were talking about the challenges of 6.9% GDP growth. Part of why they've been able to grow so fast in the past that has gone away is actually their labor force growth has gone to basically zero. So the one-child policy that they've implemented for many decades, that has had an impact of basically halting the growth in the Chinese labor force. So going forward, they're going to have to come up. It comes back in part to productivity growth like we were talking about earlier. And the other big policy challenge for China is a lot of the growth they've had over the decades has been to produce things to sell to the rest of the world in some broad sense.
So the workshop of the world, right? Absolutely. That's what people call it.
Made in China. So a lot of capital investment, a lot of exports to the rest of the world. That's not sustainable for a lot of reasons, one of which is the political frictions it generates. And so the Chinese government right now is trying to shift how companies and workers are organized to be more focused on serving the Chinese households through what typically is called consumption spending. In principle, I think a lot of people around the world agree that's a fine policy goal. But boy, you can't just wave a magic wand and take a $10 to $12 trillion economy, depending on what exchange rates we measure it today, and shift a lot of the companies and the workers towards making more goods and services to sell to households. And that's part of the slowdown. Part of the volatility in the Chinese stock market is a recognition that the policy changes needed to reorient the Chinese economy, they're many, they're complicated, and it's just not clear when and how the government's going to be changing those policies.
And that affects U.S. manufacturing, right, Matt? I mean, we hear about Caterpillar, for example, sells a lot of its heavy construction equipment to China, and it suffers when the Chinese economy slows down.
Boy, it sure does. The number of businesses in America, especially manufacturing, this is part of the slowdown in our U.S. manufacturing, is they've been building things to help China build out its capital investment, their roads, their bridges. So Caterpillar is a great example. The excavators, the earth-moving equipment. China has been a boom market for them for decades. And as China slows then, and Caterpillar has reported some tough earnings in recent months, and they've had to make some difficult choices on reducing their payrolls, that's a clear linkage of the global economy that is part of the uncertainty that we're facing in this new year.
Well, thank you again for that call. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. A couple emails I want to share with you, gentlemen. And Russ, I'll throw this one to you. It's from Christopher in Manchester, who asks, how is the economy faring in the different regions of New Hampshire? In Greater Manchester and Bedford, there seems to be lots of new construction underway, retail and apartment, condos mostly, also several new banks in Bedford. Christopher says, nice to see after years of very little activity. Christopher, thank you for jumping in. And Russ, what do you think?
Christopher's spot on. The Manchester economy is showing very good growth. Primarily, there's good manufacturing growth. Londonderry, as we know, along next to the airport, has had over 1 million square feet of new space built, primarily warehouse space built, with a lot of jobs, a lot of new investment, and spin-off growth. And so Manchester is well-positioned. The seacoast, because of its diversity, the university being there, the attractiveness of Portsmouth, Peace Trade Port, is also doing very well. And then the Upper Valley, as always, where Matt hangs out, the combination of the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, the VA Medical Center, the college itself, typically has very low unemployment rates. So those three areas of the state, Manchester, the Manchester region, the Seacoast, and Upper Valley, are doing well. Outside of those areas, not so good. Although, if you look at unemployment rates across the state, they're all relatively low. So
very low, much lower than the national average.
Right. Even
around
up in
3%.
Coos County, statewide, we're about 3%, which is definitely full employment, I think. But even in the North Country, the unemployment rate is relatively low, maybe because a lot of workers have moved out or people have dropped out of the labor force. But by and large, the concentration of growth and prosperity is in southern New Hampshire.
Well, here's another email, and thank you for that one, Christopher. This is from Edward in Franconia, who says, I have a serious question, but first I am reminded of what Ronald Reagan said about economists. You get 100 economists in a room, and you'll get 300 opinions. Thank you, Edward, for that. Here's his question. I'll throw this to you, Matt Slaughter, please. Isn't all the oil price driven by Saudi Arabia maintaining its market share at all costs, but hasn't this been done for political purposes to punish Russia since the price of oil started going down shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine? Edward says it seems more like politics than economics. Real interesting question, Edward. Thank you so much. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, great question from Edward. It speaks to the supply of oil is really different from the supply of a lot of other products in the world. It's not just another commodity in the periodic table. The countries and the firms linked to those countries that produce oil are full of geopolitical significance and strife historically. So it's an industry where over the many generations you see that the decisions of countries and their companies to produce oil or to cut back on oil production oftentimes has a lot to do with national security and geopolitical considerations, not dollars and cents. So right now, there's a lot of evidence that Saudi Arabia, being one of the world's largest producers of oil still, and importantly, one of the lowest cost producers, seems to be taking an approach of tolerating low oil prices, in part because continuing to produce a lot of oil themselves, so greater supply, to drive out of the market some of the other producers around the world, either because they don't want them producing economically or they've got security or national security concerns about those other producers. So understanding what is going to happen in the oil market is harder than a lot of other commodity markets because it's so intertwined with a lot of these security and governance issues that you don't have in a lot of other industries.
Well, and just to wrap up with you, Matt, what gives you the most hope about the U.S. economy in 2016? We started out talking about uncertainty over oil, volatility on the stock markets, concerns about China, but there's a lot of good there, as both of you mentioned. So what are you looking forward to hearing more of in 2016?
Yeah, if I use the Winnie the Pooh metaphor, the Tigger in me says the U.S. economy, the basics are still quite strong. We're close to full employment. On net, as Russ discussed earlier very well, oil price declines for America overall are positive. We consume more oil than we produce. That's not to say there's not hardship in North Dakota and Texas because of that. But for a lot of us in New Hampshire, we benefit with lower heating oil prices. We benefit with the lower price at the pump. So some of the underlying basics of economic strength that really matter for households of how's my job, are companies doing some hiring, still look quite strong. As we talked about earlier, we do need stronger wage growth in the United States. That speaks to a lot of broader policies like our policies to support investment in infrastructure, international trade and investment policies. We can be doing a lot better there. But the volatility in asset markets, it should definitely give pause. We should pay attention. But at the same time, as Russ nicely pointed out, you look around in New Hampshire here, and a lot of the businesses are doing pretty well. We could be doing better, but it isn't all Eeyore.
So how are you feeling? Since you started that analogy, Matt, I'll go with it. Are you feeling more Tiggerish or more Eeyore-ish?
A little bit like Piglet, so he's a bit nervous and excited at times. But there's a lot of strength. And I think one of the things economists aren't great at is predicting unexpected surprises, whether it's recessions when they come along or optimistically when we get real booms. You know, there's a lot of innovation that's happening in the U.S. economy. The energy revolution is pretty amazing. We've got a lot of interesting IT things happening in Silicon Valley that we see as consumers. So I think there's a lot of pluses still to hope for, and maybe with the political campaigns, we're going to get some better policies in Washington, D.C. There I'm less clear, but you can always hope.
Well, Matt, it's always good to talk to you, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Happy New Year. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, as always.
Matt Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. And finishing up with you too, Russ Thiebaud, what are you looking forward to economically in the new year?
Well, I'm looking forward to Tom Brady to tell us what's really going on in this economy and for Bill Belichick to fix it. I think that it's going to be a very interesting year economically. We've had a long run of prosperity, of growth, and we seem to have hit a soft spot. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. So I'm really excited about this year. I'm hoping for the best. There's a lot of signs that say maybe we won't quite get to the best this year.
Well, we didn't talk about housing, so maybe that's the next time, Russ. But I did want to just note that it seems very odd and a little sad for you and I to be sitting here talking about the New Hampshire economy without Dennis DeLay, longtime analyst, wonderful human being, one of the best economists who really just had his finger on what makes the New Hampshire economy tick. He died shortly before Christmas. We miss him.
I know. I feel like I lost a brother and a colleague. Dennis was humble. He was conscientious. He was competent. He was generous with his insights. We all know a great deal more about the New Hampshire economy because of his work. Dennis and I were together for 40 years, I really miss him. It was a shock to me, and it's just not the same without Dennis, and I miss him terribly.
Yeah, I feel like he should be sitting there next to you.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
I think he maybe is.
Maybe he is. Russ, thank you so much for being
here.
That's Russ Thiebaud, president of Applied Economic Research, an economic and real estate consulting firm in Laconia. Coming up, we will check in very quickly with the hot debate in the legislature over an energy policy called net metering and why New Hampshire's small but growing solar industry is upset about a cap on how much solar power can be sold back to the grid. We will find out more in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to a megawatt debate in the New Hampshire legislature over an energy policy called net metering and why the Granite State solar industry is up in arms over a cap on how much sun power can be sold back to the grid. With me in studio for the rest of the hour are Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor and blogger at Granite Geek. And Dave Brooks, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good to see you.
Well, let's start off, Dave, with a quick reminder of just what net metering is. As ungeeky as possible.
Sure, absolutely. So it's basically a law that says the utility has to buy back your excess solar power. And the parallel I've always heard is, imagine if you could only buy gasoline in groups of $20 at a time. So you went to the gas station, you bought $10 worth of gas, but you had to pay $20 and you couldn't get any change. That would be bad, and that would make it much more expensive. Well, that's what solar power used to be. I'm a little older than Sam. When I started writing about solar power, it was, you know, techno hippies in the woods, and they had nothing to do with excess power. So if the panels on your roof generate 8 kilowatt hours and you use only 6 kilowatt hours in that day, the other 2 kilowatt hours would have been wasted. But net metering laws came along in 98 it was in New Hampshire, and before that in other places, requiring the utilities to buy it back.
So now all of a sudden those 2 kilowatts, you can sell it back. Cool. It's not wasted.
Exactly. At the same price. So it makes it much more financially feasible for having panels. And really it has turned into be the killer app for solar power. It is the thing that has, as much as anything, has generated, is the reason why you see them on houses all the time now.
So everybody's happy, right, Sam? I mean, the solar people get to sell their excess power back and the utility gets, you know, some extra juice. So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that not only are solar panel owners being reimbursed their energy rate. So if you look at your bill, it's divided into two halves. You've got the energy rate and you've got the distribution rate. The distribution rate pays for the poles and wires. It also, you know, there's a number of charges built into there.
For the infrastructure.
Exactly. When you're selling solar power, you're getting reimbursed for both of those halves of the bill. That means that if you zero out your bill, you're not paying anything for the infrastructure that is serving your house at times when the sun's not shining. And the utilities say that if you have enough customers who aren't doing this, then the customers who are left, those without solar panels on their roofs, are going to see their rates start to rise, which amounts to a subsidy for solar owners. And we can get into how that's a controversial claim as we go, but basically that's the rub of the argument. And so when the net metering law was first passed, they put a cap on it. Initially it was 1% of peak load, and they sort of translated that into layman's terms, 50 megawatts. And we're now essentially at that cap, and they're now taking a pause to reevaluate the policy.
So the idea of the cap, Sam, is let's not have so much solar power that not enough people are kicking in for the cost of the infrastructure and maintaining that infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, when the net metering law was passed, the utilities saw down the road how this could result in sort of, you know, basically undermining their whole financial system for how they get paid.
I believe disrupting is the preferred term.
I want to remind everybody that you can join us with your questions and comments on this. It's been a big deal in the legislature looking at net metering, whether to raise the cap and whether we should even have a cap at all. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dave Brooks, as you said, you know, there's been solar in New Hampshire for some time, but when did this push really start to come for New Hampshire to increase the cap or maybe even get rid of the cap?
It's only been for the last couple of years, and it's because of the extreme growth of solar power. So back when net metering was passed, frankly, the utilities allowed it to happen, kind of, you know, throw a bone to the tree huggers and then leave us alone, because it was so tiny that it didn't really matter. And it still is tiny. I mean, we're talking about less than 1%, I believe, of the total amount of electricity produced in New Hampshire. But it's growing so fast in parts of the country in particular, not as much in New Hampshire but in other places, that there is talk about how it is disruptive, to use that silly term, but that it can actually send utilities' business model, just it can destroy them in just a few years. And we've seen that happen in other industries, that once it gets going, it's hard to stop. So the utilities are jumping in now and saying, wait a minute. And there are a lot of much more vicious fights in other parts of the country.
I'd say that when we talk about what has caused it to accelerate to the point where we've hit almost hit the cap here in New Hampshire, a few years ago they passed a law called group net metering, which really kicked off these sort of medium to large scale projects, which really ate into the cap very quickly. And group net metering, what that is you can share the credit from your solar array between several meters.
So my neighbors and I could sort of set up our own little
cooperative. Say you've got, you know, 10 houses and 9 of them are in the shade. made, and one of them has a gigantic barn that's, you know, facing south. So that gigantic barn, you can put a huge array, and you can share the credit between all 10 houses. And you've seen this in a big way taking off in places like private schools, you know, municipalities. That Peterborough installation, which is the largest solar array in New Hampshire now, is net metered throughout a bunch of the town buildings, including the wastewater treatment plant. And it's allowed these sort of medium to large scale projects really accelerate.
Churches have started to get into it as well.
Well, the other change that you guys haven't mentioned yet is the arrival of Solar City, a company that has, speaking of disruption, turned this whole model on its head, whereas before you used to have to spend thousands of dollars getting the panels, installing them. Now you don't even have to pay for it.
It's
and
a lease.
So that's a big change, too.
That is the other big change. And behind all this is the falling cost of the equipment, by the way. I mean, that is really the driver. It's down under $2 a watt installed in most places. And that's fallen by 80-90% in the last decade. But so SolarCity and a couple other companies, basically they lease the panels. It's like leasing a car instead of buying a car. So instead of having to spend $20,000 up front and then not have electricity bills for the next 20 years, which is the way it used to be, now you can spend nothing or virtually nothing up front and just get your electricity rate reduced over the next 20 years. And that has made it much more feasible for many people to install them. And that, as well as net metering, I do think actually that's the other main driver for residential solar.
And what's interesting about SolarCity, too, is, you know, there are local companies that have offered no-money-down loans where you can buy an array for a number of years. But they are, you know, even Revision Energy, which has got some around 200 employees, it's pretty small time compared to SolarCity, which comes in. They have huge advertising budgets.
It's a national company.
Yep. They've got, you know, customer acquisition where they're calling people up. They're going door-to-door. They're sending mailers. You know, the marketing is so much more aggressive with a company of that size.
Well, I want to ask both of you again about the bill and the legislature, what it aims to do, what people are saying about it, what you guys think might happen. But let's go to our listeners as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. John joins us from Hillsboro. Hi, John. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi there.
Go ahead, John.
My question is, how is the subsidizing of net metering by having any different from the subsidizing we do of nuclear plants by paying through the stranded cost part of our bill?
John, thank you very much. And, you know, it's a good question, guys. All sorts of energy supplies get their own subsidies in a way. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, so nuclear is kind of its own can of worms. I'm going to put that one aside for a moment. But I will piggyback off what he says to point out that another class of customers is subsidized, which is to say rural customers. So if you look at, you know, how many poles and wires it takes to serve someone who's way off in the middle of the woods compared to someone who's in the city, that's a very different amount of infrastructure, but they're both paying the same rate. So the idea that different customers get different rates is not a new one per se. The question is, where do you strike the balance in you know, accepting that kind of disparity sort of being built into this one blanket rate? As to the stranded cost, you know, charges, those are sort of incredibly political, and they tend to, you know, we'd have to unearth a very old fight in order to really explain that one.
Well, and maybe that's worth looking at nuclear power once again, because we have done other shows on that, and there's a lot going on in New England, especially with the closing of Vermont Yankee. Did you want to jump in real quick, Dave Brooks?
Just very quickly, there really isn't a free market in energy. It's a monopoly, and it's a government-regulated monopoly. So to talk about, you know, the free market rate that's sort of magically there and pretend it's there, it's not true. So everything's manipulated, and everything's subsidized, and everything's pushed or pulled back to some extent, but the devil's in the details.
Why, when we talk about net metering, guys, are we only talking about solar? Why is nobody talking about net metering for wind or biomass? Go ahead, Sam.
Well, because those sources aren't using net metering. And it's basically because only renewable energy facilities of a certain size can take advantage. What we are seeing is some small hydropower. You know, I believe we're up to two dams that are now taking advantage of the group net metering law. But you have to be under a megawatt in order to net meter. And a single wind turbine can be, of these large industrial wind turbines, can be more than a megawatt. So they don't qualify for the program.
And small wind, which we all, 10 years ago, I was certainly writing about as being the next big thing, little tiny turbines over your house, they just haven't worked out very well at all. Solar is much better at the small scale.
So this is for, you know, homes, businesses,
government
offices,
mom and pop store,
and so forth.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting. Well, okay, so what about the legislature? And Dave Brooks, I'll turn to you first. The New England Ratepayers Association says net metering hurts those customers who don't have solar, which is pretty much almost everybody still,
almost.
Although it's growing. The bill in the legislature aims to raise the cap to 75 megawatts instead of 50. What's your sort of assessment of the fight there?
This was a behind-the-scenes negotiation for a long time, and the 75 megawatt number sort of pulled out of the air, as was the 50, as is any number, frankly. And several people who spoke from the industry at the hearing of the legislature said that the 75 megawatt cap could be reached in a few weeks or a few months at the most, and we'd be right back where we were, sort of twiddling your thumbs and not being sure. I mean, you could still get solar even if the cap is met, but you wouldn't be able to automatically apply for this net metering. It might come up later, but it might not. So, and we heard testimony from a small installer in the Upper Valley. She said basically that, you know, when this happens, business just ground a halt, and everybody said, "Well, I'll wait." And so it could kind of kill the industry, which is small but growing fast. And then there are a number of jobs. A lot of guys walking around on roofs installing panels around this
day. Well, and it's interesting. We talked in our earlier segment about so-called good jobs, you know, manufacturing and so forth. Sam, give us your sense of the legislature as well. What's happening there with this bill and whether it will go through?
Yeah, making predictions about what the legislature is going to do about anything is a fraught endeavor. But basically, I mean, Dave sort of laid it out there. The solar installers, especially commercial scale, these sort of medium to large scale projects are really not satisfied with this bill. They say that they'll because the cap is 25 megawatts higher. It's divided 60-40 between commercial scale and residential scale. The 15 megawatts for the residential scale will likely last for a while, but the 10 megawatts for the commercial guys, they can go through that very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's the commercial installers who are not super pleased with it. And you know, the utilities basically say this is what you're going to get. You know, this is our compromise. This is what we've brought to the table. If you were to make me bet, I would bet that the 25 megawatt cap is where we will see the legislature stick. I don't think that they're going to give any more ground to the solar installers.
At least for now. This will probably come back.
And then what happens is what the bill does is it kicks it over to the PUC and says, "Hey, PUC, figure out a new program that will replace net metering, that will probably be a slightly less generous rate to solar installers, but will allow the solar industry to continue."
That's interesting. Okay, let's take another call. This is from Bill and Lee. Hi, Bill. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Morning.
Morning.
I have a comment in regards to all this net metering and solar panels and all these other programs that are part of the 80% tax on electricity. And that 80% tax on electricity is killing industry in New Hampshire and preventing us from competing in the world economy and preventing us from having industry, so we have to buy stuff from China.
So tie this into the solar net metering bill, please.
It's not necessary. All those programs are totally stupid. We have enough technology, or we have new technology in the United States that we can produce all our electricity for the United States and the world using waste material, okay? And it's green electricity. In other words, it doesn't pollute. And it...
It's already here. We've got all those waste products. And, you know, actually, there is a project over on the seacoast, right, in Rochester, where you've got waste energy coming in, powering UNH. So
yep.
He seems to be saying, look, let's work with what we have here.
Well, terrific until they try to build a, you know, waste energy plant next door to you, and then you will not be happy. But you're absolutely correct. I mean, the solar is not an end-all, be-all. It's never going to be at all. We need to develop lots of alternative things, combined heat and power and biomass and frankly, wind. And, frankly, fossil fuels are going to be a big part of our electricity mix for probably the rest of my life. So, It is not, you know, solar is the answer.
All right. Bill, thank you for calling in. And, you know, talking about how utility executives have responded to this disruption. Sam, you reported that in Massachusetts, some utility executives have said that net metering has cost them some money.
Yeah, so the net metering fight in Massachusetts is, just as pitched as here. It's been going on for a few years longer. Massachusetts is one of the states in which solar has developed most rapidly in the country. Basically, the situation going on down there is kind of similar to here, in which you have kind of a stop on large-scale commercial applications while the residential market is being allowed to continue under the net metering program. And meanwhile, a fix for their net metering law is stalled in the Massachusetts legislature. You've got the House and the Senate advanced different bills and have sort of come to, loggerheads. There's some thought that there might be an extension down there, but it's not clear. The Massachusetts legislature is kind of opaque. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on in there. But that said, if we talk about our cap as a 1% cap, theirs is up around 6 or 9, depending on how you measure it.
Total electricity supply?
Exactly. So we're talking about an industry that's already, many orders of magnitude larger than here in New Hampshire.
Go ahead, Dave.
And if you want to fight, you can go to Nevada.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Nevada. Thank you.
That is the poster child for the debate right now. So what happened there is the PUC, their Public Utilities Commission, not only rolled back the rates that people are paid but charged people. So you get less money for selling your electricity back, and you have to pay an extra fee if you have solar panels. Plus, they made it retroactive. So there are 15,000 people that have filed a class action suit in there because they've been told the state was incentivizing them to put these panels on. And now they've come and said, guess what? The money you thought you were going to make, you're not going to make it. So these panels are going to cost you a lot more. So that is this huge fight that has the whole industry all over the country staring.
Wow. So not just a fee, but a retroactive fee.
Retroactive.
Ouch.
That's the
you
painful
You are not
part.
Grandfathered.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
I So guess it could be a lot uglier here.
Thank you, gentlemen. Real interesting stuff. Thanks for being here. Good to see you, Dave Brooks.
Good to see you.
Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor, blogger at Granite Geek. Sam Evans-Brown, thanks for helping us out.
Thank you.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larsen. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.